Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Linda Siegel. She is our legislative correspondent. She does the legislative preview before the legislative session every year, and then the legislative update, and now we're here for the legislative wrap-up. She's a lobbyist in areas of healthcare and education and social services. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
So we have had an interesting session this year. We've had a session and a special session.
Yes, indeed.
Because our legislators, for the first time in a couple of decades, couldn't pass a budget.
Right, since I think 1984 or 86.
Right, an Orwellian year.
Yeah.
So what happened? Let's start with the special session. They went in with hundreds of millions of dollars, basically in the red, that had to be either cut from spending or added in terms of revenue. What happened?
Well, that was one of the problems in the 30-day session, that they just couldn't figure it out. We needed to cut about $600 million from our budget, which begins July 1 of this year. And in order to do that, many, many people, many advocacy groups, and many legislators wanted to not just cut, since we'd already cut almost $1 billion from our budget since 2008, they wanted to look at some other solutions, and tax increases are just about the only thing you can do.
So, and tax increases have been given a bad name because taxes are supposed to be evil, but it is sort of how the world goes around.
Well, right, and almost every other state in the country has been raising taxes in these hard economic times. So there's no reason that we shouldn't do reasonable taxes in New Mexico. And that's what the legislators were struggling with. It's an election year. All 70 House members' seats are up this year. People were paranoid about, what am I going to do? I don't know if I can vote for taxes or not. And, of course, the Republicans took a pretty hard line saying no new taxes. So we knew there were going to be no votes for taxes from them.
So what happened? How did they solve? Well, first of all, has the budget been balanced in the special session? Is that $60 million made up for?
$600
million. So, that's what I mean.
Well, that's a really good question, and it depends on whether the governor signs the tax bills that pass, and it also depends on the revenue projections, because if the revenue projections don't meet the expectations of the budget, then the budget won't be balanced. So as it is now, if everything goes well, then the budget is balanced. But of course, in New Mexico, as in every other state, you cannot run a deficit budget. We have to balance the budget, and they will balance the budget one way or the other. If it means coming back again for another special session in a few months, that's a possibility too.
What taxes finally were added?
Well, to address that $600 million deficit, they made significant cuts in many, many departments. And the tax bills that passed, a tobacco tax for 75 cents, which will start July 1.
So every pack of cigarettes you buy, 75 cents.
Right. Now, an interesting addition to that bill, which will make it a little more palatable for people who say, well, if you raise the taxes, then people will just go to the tribal smoke shops. An amendment to that bill says that the tribes have to raise their prices 75 cents also, and that the tribe can keep that money, but that they have to, in order to get the tax stamp, they have to raise their price that much. So that'll still give the tribes the same benefit they have now, which is a 91 cent benefit, but it won't add another burden. And this tax goes into effect, as I said, July 1. It's about a $33 million tax. $22 million of it will go to the general fund to pay for all the regular stuff of government, and $11 million is going to early childhood for 1 year.
Early childhood?
Early childhood services like state assistance, programs that help educate people who work in the child care programs.
Not to smoke.
Yeah. and other things. And that will end in 1 year, and the whole tax bill has a 4-year sunset. So in 4 years, the tax goes away unless the legislature repeals it. I guess that was a special perk we needed to give to the tobacco industry.
Ah, yes.
Because the other taxes that we pass do not have a sunset on them.
Very interesting.
And those bills all, though there were three bills and they all got rolled into one bill. So they contain a 1/8% gross receipts tax increase. Everything that we buy has gross receipts tax on it. Services, like if you're an accountant, a CPA, a lawyer, a lobbyist, you have to pay gross receipts tax. Well, that gross receipts tax goes up 1/8%. In addition, we as you remember, we repealed the food tax in 2003. What this bill does is takes that legislation and repeals it. It's complicated. Gives a 5% credit to the state, but then cities and counties will implement a food tax. And that tax is about 2%. It depends on the city or the county that you live in. I'm not sure what Santa Fe's will be. It might be a little more than 2%. But when they originally passed that bill, the state held the cities and the counties harmless. And really what they did was take away that provision of the law. So now the cities and the counties can charge the food tax, but the state can't.
So what about the tax? I mean, for a while it was a tax on junk food, so white flour tortillas were going to be taxed, but whole wheat tortillas weren't. What is there a differentiation? Is it back to all food?
It's all foods. That was a tax, that was a bill that would have said anything defined in the Women, Infant, Children, the WIC program, which are supposed to be wholesome foods, they would not be taxed and everything else would be taxed. And that was the white tortilla versus the wheat tortilla battles, the tortilla fights. But that bill is gone, and it's just a straight across-the-board city-county food tax, and that's going to depend where you live.
We're talking to Linda Siegel.
And then there's a third component of that bill, which is the only progressive, those two taxes I just talked about obviously are regressive taxes because they impact poor people, middle-income people, rich people, and they impact poor people more because a larger percentage of their income goes to buy goods and services and food. The progressive part of the bill is what we call a PIT add-back, a personal income tax add-back. We're one of five or six states in the country that allow people who itemize their returns, their income tax returns, to deduct their state and local taxes. And this bill would simply say, oh, sorry, you can't do that. You have to pay tax on those.
Is that retroactive to 2009?
No, to January of this year.
So, in other words, when we, coming up to April 15th, fill out our tax forms for 2009, it doesn't apply?
It's regular, yeah, just like it was in the past.
Okay.
So these bills together generate about $220 million.
So $220 million out of the necessary $600 million, what does that mean? That almost $400 million worth of cuts have been made?
Well, not quite that much, because we did some things in the last session, which was, what, 2 weeks ago when it ended, that would give some temporary relief. And one of those was to take back some of the capital outlay, about $130 or $40 million worth of capital outlay that hadn't been spent, reverted to the general fund, and that will be used to shore up the reserves of the state. And some other cuts along the way will kind of make up for whatever little wiggle room there is in the cuts that should have gone into the budget or the tax increases that should have gone in. But it theoretically is a balanced budget.
Theoretically is a balanced budget. Now, let's say that the recession that we may or may not be in, depending on whom you ask, gets worse or kind of limps along, and our gross receipts tax revenues turn out to be not nearly as good as they're projected to be. What happens then? We still have a deficit.
Right, and then we're back to a special session because we can't run a deficit in New Mexico.
Ah.
And that's where, I mean, that's one of the things that legislators were concerned about. What were the projections going to be into the next 6, 8, 12 months? And they have been declining. Gas and oil revenues are up, but gross receipts taxes are down. So are those going to balance out and keep the budget solid? We don't know yet. And
stay tuned to KSFR.
That's right. We'll be the first to let you know.
So we're talking to Linda Siegel. What else? Anything else that you want to tell us about the special session?
Well, there was one important bill that, at least on behalf of the Santa Fe Public Schools, that we were really concerned about and didn't pass, unfortunately. And that was what's called a supplemental severance tax bond. And we call them sponge bonds. And up at the legislature, we call them SpongeBobs. So one of those, it's a way to take severance tax money and use it for...
What is severance tax?
Severance tax is the money that comes off of oil and gas revenues. And we always take severance tax and we use it for capital outlay.
You take oil and gas taxes and use them to build senior centers and...
Right. Yeah, that's one of the uses of
and schools.
Severance tax, yeah, to use for capital outlay. But this would be taking that money and not using it for capital outlay and using it for general fund. But
meaning to keep the actual schools open.
Right. And there was a $150 million sponge bond proposed, which passed out of the House. And in that bill, there was $25 million to go to public education, to their funding formula, what we call the SEG. And that $25 million was very important to keep the schools at their current levels of operation. That bill died in the Senate because the Senate Finance Committee would not hear the bill. That means that the funding formula for the public schools is $25 million short, and then a little movida on the tobacco tax, where that $11 million was supposed to go for the public schools, and it got changed to go to early childhood programs. So they ended up losing $36 million to the funding formula, meaning that overall education, public education, which is 45% of the total state budget, about $2.4 billion, lost about 1.7%.
And so can they somehow make that up, or what happens? Or are we going to see schools closing? Or?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. It has a huge impact in Santa Fe, and schools closing is a great possibility, larger classrooms. I mean, all over the state, Albuquerque will have the same problem. Small school districts will have to look at ways to address the fact that they're going to be getting a significant amount less per student than in the past, because what the funding formula is a per student rate.
So we see bake sales in the future. Okay, so let's go on to the session. We did a weekly legislative update during the session, but let's talk in a kind of summary way about what actually passed in various areas. For example, 80 bills passed during the 30-day session.
Right. The session where the only constitutional requirement is to do a budget.
They didn't do a budget.
We had 500 bills and memorials introduced, and 80 of them actually passed.
That's a high percentage.
Is it
compared to usual?
Not unusual, the percentage of bills passing. But what is unusual, I think, is the number in a 30-day session.
Because
there were a lot of complicated issues that were on the table.
So what passed?
Okay, well, let's talk about education then, because there were a number of bills. There were probably 40 education bills. And some really important ones passed, because in the last legislative session in 2009, a bill was passed and signed by the governor that said that the school year had to be 180 days. Well, we had to come back this legislative session and temporarily stop that from going into effect, because with huge budget cuts coming down to public education, that kind of mandate just isn't going to work. And some other bills related to that, there is a bill that passed that would allow for a waiver that the Secretary of PED could waive,
PED,
Public Education Department, could waive class size, teacher requirements, length of days, staffing patterns, the different materials purchased, because of the budget crunch. And that's an important bill because that will give the districts the flexibility, because we have in law how many people you can have in a classroom, how many kids can be in a classroom. And we're going to have to waive that requirement probably.
So it will cut into teacher and staff salaries to some extent here and there. It'll increase class size, but
materials
they'll get by.
Educational materials, books, those kinds of things.
I was once here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, and I went into the ladies' room, and I found a list of what the parents were required to buy for their teachers, from the teacher had sent this list, for their children's class.
Uh-huh.
It was all the stuff that, when I was in school, the school provided.
Right, yeah. No more.
No more.
Yep, and it's even going to get tighter.
Okay.
Another education bill, which was quite controversial and took hours and hours of debate on both the House floor and the House Senate, was the Hispanic Education Act, because many of our Hispanic students are not graduating, and it's a much higher percentage than other kids. So this bill was pushed by the governor, and what it ended up to be was a Hispanic education liaison will be created in the Department of Public Education, and that person's role will be to work on figuring out strategies for how to get more Hispanic kids to graduate. Another important one, which I think is particularly poignant in our current economic situation, is a requirement to teach financial literacy as part of the math curriculum pass, so that it's mandatory now that we have to teach kids about financial literacy.
Interesting.
Yeah, a really good one. Forcing boards, local school boards, to have audit and finance committees. I mean, we're really lucky in Santa Fe because we've already been doing that for years. All of our superintendents have believed in that. But a lot of schools don't have it. So it's trying to make more accountability with the local school board. So quite a few education bills. Another one that will greatly impact the teachers and all the staff at the public schools is that their ERB contribution.
ERB.
That's their education retirement contribution.
Catch those acronyms.
Yeah, sorry. Will be going up almost 2%, so they're going to have to contribute more to their retirement fund because it is not solvent.
Ah.
It is billions of dollars not solvent. So the legislature is working on ways to try to make that, and now everybody's going to have to contribute more. So here in these economic times, even wages are going to go down because health insurance premiums are going up, retirement now going up, and wages are not.
So let's talk about health. Any health care bills that actually came to pass?
Well, one health care bill, health insurance bill, that's been introduced like for four or five years now, to require that health insurance companies spend 85% of their premiums on actually the delivery of health care. There's a novel idea. And that actually finally passed this year with some adjustments, so that if it's an individual policy, then it only has to be 75% of the premium spent on actual delivery of healthcare services. But it is a start. There are certainly insurance companies, particularly with individual policies, that might not be spending that much. So that's a positive thing, and that's also something the federal government was looking at passing. So we've already done it in New Mexico if the governor signs the bill, which I'm sure he will because he was pushing this in prior years. Another bill, which is important to us as women, is the no use of gender for determining the insurance rates of those policies.
Very interesting.
Yes, because oftentimes, just because we're women, we pay 20% more for our insurance. So this bill requires over the next 4 years that be reduced to zero. So by 2014, then insurance companies can no longer use gender as a rating determinant for the cost of insurance policies. And it goes down every year. It starts at 15, goes down to 10, and then 5, and eventually 0.
Now, all those health insurance lobbyists that have been swarming over Washington for the last year, did they come to New Mexico and try to get those things defeated?
Well, we have our own health insurance lobbyists here who did work hard to get the compromise on the health insurance, the 85-75%, and they also were opposed to the gender ratings because they say women cost more. But right is right. And, and I'm sure the governor will sign that bill. And then another bill that required 5 more tests for newborns. So there's this whole screening panel for babies when they're born. They get all these genetic tests, and there 5 more were added. It's interesting how we do this in legislation rather than, you know, letting the healthcare community decide this. But that's the way we work here. And a bill that changes the rules for HIV testing for criminals. If someone has been picked up for a sex crime or some kind of where there's contact and blood exchange, the victim can request that a HIV test be done within 48 hours. We also had some domestic violence bills. The governor has been a big champion of domestic violence, and he
He's been a champion
of domestic violence prevention. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Sorry about that. Sorry, Governor. he's really worked hard to beef up funding for domestic violence prevention and changing the laws. And this year there were several bills introduced. One was to create a domestic violence commission, which will be made up of a number of people. He did this by executive order, but he wanted to put it in law before he goes, so that'll stay in effect. And a very important bill, which failed, which did not pass, which said that if a police officer had been convicted of a domestic violence offense, then they would automatically not be able to become a police officer. And that bill, we couldn't get it through.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And it was opposed by the Police and Sheriff's Association.
Who want convicted criminals to be policemen.
I can't say why, but it's very strange.
Moving right along.
Yes. An important bill, I think, for the transparency that we all talk about, that we want to see in government and rarely see, is there will be created a website that hopefully will be user-friendly, that will post the budgets of all agencies, the tax revenues, where those revenues are coming from, like how much come from this fee and that fee and how much come from the different taxes. Investment, talk about our investments and where they are. Also list the names and the salaries of all exempt employees. That's been a very controversial issue with Governor Richardson. And list all the government jobs by classification, by title. The names of the classified employees won't be listed with their salaries, but the job title will be. And that should be up, I think, within a year or so.
That's great.
And that'll be a really good thing for transparency and for research and finding out what's going on.
So we've got a few minutes left. Run us through other bills that did pass.
Okay, some other important bills related to finances. You know, there's been a lot of controversy around the State Investment Council and the governor's perhaps interference with things there. And so a bill passed to actually limit the governor's ability to appoint people and gives that ability to the legislature. I'm not sure how much better that is, but gives them some input in that and says that the state investment officer, rather than the governor, will do the hiring and issue the contracts. That's another bill for better government and transparency. Another bill related to better government is a bill that would create a task force to do government restructuring and brings together people, public members and legislative members, to look at, can we consolidate any departments of government? Can we eliminate departments? And they'll be working over the next year to look at that, and there'll be an opportunity for public input in that.
Is there a redundancy in government that... I mean, do you see that kind of thing?
Well, when I look at the 30 years I've been working around the legislature, we've consolidated departments, we've separated departments. We used to have one human service health department, and then we split it out into human services and health. We used to have the agency on aging, and then we created a long-term care department and made it separate. So we created the Children, Youth, and Families Department. So we have expanded departments, and probably for good reason to specialize, but maybe we need to consolidate some of the smaller departments, and we'll see what this task force comes up with. I think we should talk quickly about what didn't pass.
Yes.
Once again, the domestic partnership bill did not pass.
Now, that's been one of Governor Richardson's
big
causes.
Yes. He's been working on that for several years, since 2007. He's been a great champion. He's always put it on the call, which means it can be heard in a 30-day session when we're only supposed to be doing the budget. And it, once again, failed in the Senate.
By not too much?
By, well, one vote in the, or two votes in the Senate Finance Committee.
So this would have given people who do not want to get married or can't get married because they're same-sex couples and it's against the law to get married, basically the rights, duties, and privileges of marriage.
Right, right. And it's just, it's for opposite sex as well as same-sex, people who are on federal benefits, who don't want to lose that, or their Social Security, and yet they want to want the protections of partnership, they can do it too, as well as same-sex couples who do it for whatever reason they want to.
So we'll be talking about this next year.
I'm sure we will.
It's the new cockfighting.
Yes. It took 12 years for the Non-Discrimination Act to pass, and this will be the third year of the domestic partnership.
What else didn't pass?
A bill that would have consolidated all of the health care boards, which was a really bad idea, I think, but putting all the boards like nursing and pharmacy and chiropractors and occupational therapists under the Board of Medicine. Well, health care practices are very specialized, and that really set people off, health care professionals off, and the Board of Medicine didn't want to do it either. So that bill didn't pass.
So, Linda Siegel, that's it for now. If we have another special session before the next legislative session, we will see you then.
I think so. I think it's likely, unfortunately,
that we
will. And we'll see if the governor line item vetoes any of that tax. If he line item vetoes the food tax, then we'll be back in a couple of months, probably.
And I did want to ask you, how much does this special session cost the taxpayers?
It costs $50,000 a day to do a special session like we just had, where there's minimal staff. You just have the legislative council staff and a few secretaries for the leadership and the certain committees. But otherwise, it's more like $350,000 a day, I think.
Linda Siegel is a lobbyist, and she is our legislative correspondent. This has been the Legislative Wrap-Up. Linda Siegel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm happy now to welcome Pam Coleman. She is the State Field Director of Organizing for America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much. Very nice to be here.
Now, what is Organizing for America?
Organizing for America is the successor organization to the Obama campaign. After the inauguration, there was a decision made based on surveys and requests to folks who had been involved in the campaign as to what kind of organization they wanted to be part of going forward. And overwhelmingly, people said they wanted to be involved. They wanted to be involved in issues campaigning. They wanted to be involved in making sure that they stayed involved in their community. So Organizing for America was born out of that desire by supporters who had been involved to stay involved.
Now, the campaign was really unprecedented in the involvement of ordinary people. Many people who'd never even voted before came out, and so on. And people who'd never given money to a political campaign before, and so on. How has that been after the election and really after the first year mark?
Well, it's a great question because, as you say, so many people were new to it. And in fact, I was new to it. I had been politically aware but never politically active until the Obama campaign.
Really?
When I became one of the super vols, as they said, I traveled to
super volunteers.
Super volunteers. I was actually living in Italy when the campaign started. So when the Republican Party announced their vice presidential candidate, it became a really rallying cry for me personally. And I came back from Italy, and I found a friend in a battleground state where I could live, which was Florida. And I lived on their couch for 2 months, and I worked for the Obama campaign. And it changed my life. I mean, literally changed my life. I'd gone from just politically aware to politically active, and understanding that community organizing was the most important thing that I could do personally, that seeing the folks who were involved for the very first time, understanding what was important to them in their own communities and their own lives, with the fact that they couldn't send their kids to college, or they didn't think so, they barely could make their mortgage payment, the economy was falling apart, that it was really critical to me personally, as I saw and experienced these people, to get involved in a way personally. So when the campaign ended, like a lot of people, there was a huge letdown of momentum for me and for most people after, because there was a huge euphoria having elected President Obama. But then it was, okay, my job is done, because I didn't know what it was like to be politically involved.
Well, and there's a sense, I think, on the part of voters for whom voting is the primary expression of citizenship, that, okay, that's all I can do.
And that's also an important point in what Organizing for America is about. Because if we leave it only to Election Day, if we don't stay involved in our communities and stay involved in politics from a local level to a national level, we can't blame anyone if things don't go our way. And when it comes to governance and campaigning, they're two very different worlds. And so this is a conversation I have on a daily basis as to, well, the campaign, they thought, was going to go in one direction, and then the campaign gets to Washington and the president has to govern. And he said most recently, as of Wednesday, this would have been last Wednesday, that it's not a political thing to do when you have to make a hard decision. You need to make a hard decision if it's the right thing for the country. And I think that's a really difficult place for people to be in, who had been so excited and euphoric about the president's campaign.
I think there are many people who felt that Obama ran on a platform of change in some very specific areas, and then when it really comes down to it, you know, huge amounts of money going to military spending, health care being a little stalled, and we'll talk about health care in a moment, and policies very much continuing in the Bush era vein. And they're saying, I mean, many people saying, what changed? What did we vote for? I'm going back into my hole and not voting anymore.
Also a very good point, and one that I do hear every day. And what I remind folks is that when Senator Obama ran, he did run on a platform of hope and change. But hope and change is very different things to different people. So I say that if there's a candidate who I can vote for and my dad can vote for in the same breath.
Who's your dad?
My dad's a bit of a Republican back east. That if we can vote for the same candidate.
He voted for Obama?
He did. If we can vote for the same candidate, then there's someone who's going to be disappointed when it comes time for governance. And also, Obama ran as a centrist Democrat. He never ran as an ideologue. He said specifically, I want to get us out of Iraq. And he specifically said, we're going to have to look more closely at Afghanistan. So there are policies that we all wanted as a very progressive community, people who wanted to think hope and change meant a certain thing. But when when you look at what the underlying agenda was during the campaign and what President Obama said during the campaign closely, you'll see that it didn't push such a far agenda on either side. And that's what I think people, if they stop to think about what was really said during the campaign, and then understanding that when you get to Washington, things must progress in a certain vein. You have two parties now. There's a way that we have to make things work from a governmental standpoint and a governance standpoint.
So healthcare is one of the areas that you were looking at, and it's one of the things that I think everybody, regardless of political party, I can't even believe this is a partisan issue, is really concerned about, because a lot of people literally cannot afford to get sick. Where are we now? I mean, we've had this sort of filibuster-proof majority of Democrats in the Senate, and then now it became 59 Democrats rather than 60, and there is this idea. I mean, if I recall correctly, in the years that I've been alive that Republicans have been in office, they never needed 60 votes in the Senate to do anything, but somehow when Democrats are, they do. What's going on?
Healthcare has been talked about for 50, 100 years. It's been negotiated and debated for the last year. As the president's recently said, there's really not much more that we can talk about with respect to healthcare. There's nothing new we can say. All the ideas are on the table, and the time has come for the Congress to put their money where their mouth is and help the American people. And every major poll from Pfizer to Newsweek to the Washington Post that discusses healthcare with folks, everybody overwhelmingly wants to change the system. If you pitch any sort of poll as that doesn't take into consideration the underlying elements of what the president's health care program is, then people are freaked out because there's been an operating anti-machine against what health care is. If you ask people the underlying...
Wait a minute, an operating what?
The opposition has had a very pronounced and ambitious campaign against health care.
Against health care reform.
Against health care reform, exactly. So, but if you ask people about the underlying premises of the president's plan, which is it fair to have pre-existing conditions that prevent people from getting health insurance? No. Pre-existing conditions are wrong. Is it fair to discriminate based on gender? No, that's wrong. Is it fair to tap out someone's benefits over time? No. Should you drop people when they're sick? No. All those things which are the basis of health insurance reform, everybody can agree on. What gets lost in the shuffle is how it gets packaged. And because it got packaged in a way in our hyper-media-sensitive society where everybody can blog and everybody can have a website and everyone can weigh in 24/7, it doesn't give anybody the opportunity to really study the issue. So a show like yours, which actually addresses issues, you know, in a period of time, gives people the opportunity to think about it rather than just getting the bam, bam, every soundbite that comes out gets as much credibility and credence as every other soundbite. Nothing is really distilled. So what's happening now is that the president has proposed a final negotiated settlement between the House and the Senate, adding the best of the Republican ideas, and telling the Congress now it's time to pass it. There's no longer any time to wait. So the House, the procedure is that the House will pass the Senate bill, and that the Senate will go to a majority vote on some extra provisions, and then the House will say, yes, I'm happy with that, and the president will sign it. And that's what the procedure is.
So basically, all the things that were in the House bill, like the public option, don't even have a chance of coming back into the final bill? It's just the Senate bill and nothing else?
No, the Senate bill has, the president has proposed alterations and modifications to the Senate bill. But the problem with the public option is that not enough senators have weighed in on it to say they would vote for it. So I think we're, as of right now...
The New Mexico delegation has.
Absolutely, and we applaud their efforts. But I think there are 26 or 27 senators, and you need 51 senators. So, unfortunately, it seems at this moment, as we sit here today, now, of course, in anything...
Would they vote against it if it were in there? Would they have voted against a health care reform package that had the public option in it just because it had it in it?
Well, I'm not sure if that's the if that would be true. However, in order to get it back in, it's not clear that the public option could actually go into the majority vote because it's not purely a funding issue. And when it gets thrown back to the Senate in that 51 majority, they have to be specific budgetary items, which the parliamentarian has weighed in on.
I thought that was the most specific budget item because it would bring down health care costs by providing a government competition to private industry.
And that's, it is, what you're saying is true. However, it's the, how does it get funded? I mean, so example, the 51 majority is normally seen in taxes and budget reconciliation, which is how it's been used by the Republicans for the last in the last 15 or 20 years. So every vote
to pass anything.
To pass anything.
So?
But they're all budgetarily related. So it's a budget reconciliation, purely budget reconciliation to the tax cuts. They're specifically and purely with respect to budget. So with respect to the public option, if the public option had come back in purely without being a majority, without it being the majority, then surely it would be in. But it didn't. It hasn't gone through. It didn't get out of the House in a way that could get to the Senate in a way. And again, we're talking about governance. We're talking about you have 535 legislators and a president who wants certain things, but you have 535 folks who need to agree to the extent they can on behalf of legislation. And this is really important to remember, that every major piece of legislation that's come out in the last 40 years, from Medicare to Social Security to the Civil Rights Act, people on both sides screamed about those acts when they first were signed. Over time, they all got better, all of them. So
in other words, oh, this isn't strong enough, this doesn't have everything that we need in it, that kind of thing.
Every single one. So what we say is that from an Organizing for America standpoint, and we are the field team for the president, that's our role, that's our job. We say, listen, recognize that all these things happen, all these bills happen in the past, these laws got better. Let's get something passed. This is the time we need to pass it. If we don't pass it and the midterm elections come up in November, and I'm sure all your listeners are sophisticated enough to know that in November there will be a huge, there could be a turnover in the House and the Senate.
Well, every single person in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. is up for re-election, and what, a third of the people in the Senate?
So, and it is traditional that when there's a new president in place, there is usually a decent loss to that president's party. So this is the time to pass this bill. This is the time to get it in place so that we can make it better.
We're talking to Pam Coleman. She is the state field director of Organizing for America. Now, what, I mean, this is a, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show was because recently somebody was saying, and I can't remember where this quotation is from, that Americans have gotten to the point where we see ourselves as consumers and voters, and that is how we express ourselves, and not so much as citizens. And so this question of what does citizenship mean, what does participatory citizenship mean, I think we do see this in Santa Fe with people going to the city council meetings and having, as we just saw, very active elections for city council and mayor and local positions and things like that. But how can people be citizens on a national level? I read a lot of online, both blogs and newspapers and reporting from various sources, and I do see, I mean, one of the things that struck me most in healthcare, I was on one of those, I think it was the New York Times, but then people can make their comments, and one person said, I'm an emergency medical technician, and I've been to the scenes of many accidents where people are refused to be transported in, you know, with injuries, with serious injuries, in an ambulance, because they're more afraid of going bankrupt than they are of suffering from their injuries that were sustained in a fire or a car accident. And it's things like that that really blew my mind about the healthcare. These are things you don't always hear. But back to the question of citizenship, how do you see people coming into citizenship and actually participating on a national level?
Well, it's a really great question, because this is what Organizing for America is all about. And going back just to your point about healthcare and people being petrified of going bankrupt because they have to go be transported with their injuries, this is one of the major reasons that we need health insurance reform, because it shouldn't be that you decide to have a concussion and go home and try to keep your eyes open all night than it is to go to the emergency room and be treated, because these services are there to treat you.
I mean, it's crazy, and no developed country except us has that.
Absolutely not. And so that's all the more reason. It is a crying shame that the United States has a healthcare system the way it is. We need to fix it, and we need to fix it by passing healthcare reform now and then building on it and making it better and better. So that being said, the participatory democracy that we live in, and it's an interesting quote about consumerism and being a voter, even here in Santa Fe, the turnout for the mayoral and city council elections was, 25 or 27%. It was woefully low. And it's not that it was lower than average. It was probably just about average. But the way that we can change our society is to be involved locally. And it's not just politically. It's not just I'm going to go campaign and campaign for city council. It's how can I be involved in my community in a way that makes my community better? So if it's running for school board or city council or land commissioner, that's terrific. But if it's more close to home, as in my neighborhood, my neighbor needs a neighborhood watch program, or my kids need to have a crossing guard, or anything that's going to make you and your neighbor's lives better by actively standing up and saying, we need to band together. I'm going to have my voice be heard, but I'd like other voices to be heard with me. That's the essence of being in a community. So a community organizer is just a facilitator in order to get that to happen, to find that spark, whatever's important to that particular citizen, and saying, okay, that's important to you. Let's find a way to make that issue important in a way that gets something done.
Well, having a crossing guard, and I've seen movements to save the lives of prairie dogs and environmental issues and health issues on a local level, health and safety and school. And these are things that people can feel empowered about because they are local issues, and because, especially in a city of this size, a lot of people know each other and you get to know people because it's a small town. But then when you look at things like banking reform and the fact that people who are working in these just gigantic, powerful banks on Wall Street have no relationship to the rest of us, to ordinary people, but are taking tremendous advantage of our lives and our paychecks through their policies. It's pretty hard to get around it. And feeling like you can be a participant on the big issues or on the untold billions going to military spending, whatever it is that is your that's your thing. How can we be a participatory citizen in terms of those things?
Okay. So think about the first example that you gave with respect to the banks and the big banks. I mean, I'm sure most of your listeners know about Brian Egolf's bill to divest and have money that's in big giant banks outside of New Mexico borders come back home and be in New Mexico so that it can benefit New Mexicans and benefit New Mexican businesses. And so that was a state legislator.
Came close.
Came very close, but it came so close. And so people rallied around that and became aware of it and became aware of it as an issue. And don't think that it might not happen next term, because now people are aware. So you have a state legislature, a rookie, really, who had a great idea, who people rallied around. And so the rest of the legislature will know that this is something that's going to have to be reckoned with. And so I think, as I recall, I was at a town hall with Brian and with Peter Wirth, and I'm pretty sure one of the constituents, a constituent from their districts, had come to them with this idea. I'm pretty sure, and they can correct me, and they can call in and correct me if I'm wrong. But if that's the case, then I'm pretty sure it was that issue. You're talking about a citizen who just decides, you know, I have a good idea. Let me get in touch with my representative. Let me see who's sympathetic to this issue. I mean, how much more participatory can you get?
Right.
He got this close.
Right.
So we all have a voice. It's a voice.
So it's really finding creative ways to get those ideas out there. Yeah, I've been trying to get people to legalize marijuana and then tax the living heck out of it. That's solve our budget problems in the state of New Mexico. We're talking to Pam Coleman. All right, so you are part of Organizing for America. I'm not kidding about that. I mean, anyway, Organizing for America, are you looking for participants? Are you looking for people in Santa Fe? I mean, you're the state field director. Are you looking for people in greater New Mexico? And if so, what can they do?
Well, up until recently, I was the regional field director for Santa Fe and northern New Mexico, and I have been here since the fall recruiting potential volunteers, listening to what people have to say about what issues are important to them, what can we do that makes your life better, and how can we do that together, and how can we do that on a national stage. So we are always looking for people to come together. We're looking for people to come together on local issues. We're looking for people to come together on national issues. Right now we're talking about healthcare. We'll talk about financial regulatory reform, the jobs creation. We'll talk about the Recovery Act. And then come November, we'll talk about electing candidates who are supportive of presidential policies, which are all about helping the middle class and helping people live better lives. So I'm always looking for volunteers. Organizing for America is always looking for volunteers. I can certainly, folks can log on to organizingforamerica.com to find things that are going around near them. There are events that go on periodically. In fact, I have strategy sessions coming up all around the state, including locally here in Los Alamos. I have one coming up on the 10th. But we are always in the business of helping people organize. And I see my job very specifically as inspiring people, educating them about the issues, and then organizing them. And as I said earlier, I moved back here from Italy. I had La Dolce Vita. I came back here because I passionately believe that when people have a spark and can be pointed in the right direction, that there's nothing that Americans can't do. Nothing.
Pamela Coleman, how can people get in touch with you?
They can call me directly or they can send me an email. My email is Coleman, Coleman, at dnc.org, or they can call me at 505-715-0787. I will take every call and respond to every email.
Pam Coleman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and then jazz.